Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Civil Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, December 21st, 2017, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we will be discussing disparate impact in school discipline. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us Roger B. Clegg, President and General Counsel at the Center for Equal Opportunity, and Jason Riley, Senior Fellow at the Manhattan Institute and columnist at the Wall Street Journal. After opening remarks from Roger, we'll go to audience question and answer. Thank you for speaking with us, Roger. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Laura, and thank you to the Federalist Society for hosting this. I'm very excited about today's call. We were talking beforehand that it's not often that we get a rock star like Jason Riley to join us. Jason is an outstanding columnist for the Wall Street Journal and works at the Manhattan Institute. And this topic in particular that we're talking about today, school discipline and racial disparities, is very topical. It's very interesting. It's very controversial. Jason wrote a wonderful column about it that got a lot of attention. But since we have Jason and since he writes so well on such a variety of topics, I'm going to ask him to talk after we begin the discussion with school discipline a little more broadly about some of his other work in related areas. So let me get to the topic of race and school discipline and give just a little overview. It's, I think, particularly fitting that this be a topic for a Federalist Society teleforum because the Regulatory Transparency Project, which is under the aegis of the Federalist Society, has been dealing with this issue. I'm a member of the wonderfully titled Race and Sex Working Group of the Regulatory Transparency Project, and we're looking at a variety of issues that involve race and sex and government regulation. And that group is chaired, by the way, by my boss, Linda Chavez, at the Center for Equal Opportunity. And the thing that sort of piqued our interest in this particular issue is the fact that in the Obama administration, the Office for Civil Rights at the Education Department sent out one of these notorious, dear colleague letters to all the different school districts and administrators, telling them that the office was going to be making very aggressive use of the disparate impact approach to civil rights enforcement in the area of school discipline. And what this meant, in a nutshell, was that if school districts disciplined students in a way that led to racial disparities, that is, if a higher percentage of this race rather than that race of students was being disciplined, then that would be considered to be presumptively illegal. And the burden would shift to the school district to prove to the Office for Civil Rights satisfaction that there was some necessity, some degree of necessity for those school discipline policies. Now, the fact of the matter is that for a variety of reasons, which we'll be discussing, there are racial disparities in the extent to which students are disciplined. African-American students tend to be disciplined at a higher rate than, say, Asian American students or white students. Latino students also have, higher than average discipline rates. But these disparities reflect basically not racism, but the fact that again, for a variety of reasons, African Americans get in trouble at school more frequently than other students do. And if you tell school districts that they can't discipline these children, that they have to get their numbers right, they're going to do one of two things. They're either going to start disciplining white and Asian students who don't need to be disciplined in order to get their numbers right, or, you know, more likely, and this is probably what the Education Department, you know, had in mind, they're going to start foregoing disciplining African-American students who otherwise would be disciplined. And the result of that is going to be more disruption in the classrooms. And that is going to itself have a disparate impact, because these classrooms that have disruptions in them are more likely, again, for a variety of reasons, to have African-American students and Latino students who are not themselves discipline problems, but are in classrooms with children who are discipline problems. But if those children aren't disciplined, they are the ones, you know, the well-behaved African-American and Latino students are the ones who are going to suffer. And, of course, the other group that's going to suffer is going to be teachers. And sometimes the suffering is not simply, you know, the frustration of having a classroom that's, you know, where teaching is not getting done, but there's actual, you know, physical violence and physical threats. Well, you know, needless to say, we thought on this group that this dear colleague letter was very unfortunate and should be, you know, withdrawn. Not only does it raise policy problems, but it also raises legal problems, because the courts, the Supreme Court and lower courts have recognized that imposing what are de facto racial quotas in this situation is, you know, not only bad policy, but illegal. So we have urged the Education Department to withdraw that letter. The Trump administration has withdrawn, you know, other Dear Colleague letters issued during the Obama administration, but has not yet withdrawn this one, although it is looking at it, and we hope that soon the administration will be withdrawing it. Well, again, I wanted to give a little bit of background to the issue and a little bit of background on the work that the Regulatory Transparency Project at the Federalist Society has been doing in this, but I've talked too long, and I want to now turn things over to Jason Riley of the Manhattan Institute and columnist for the Wall Street Journal to talk about this issue some more. Jason?
Thank you, Roger. As you know, this is the suspension rate issue. You know, the black suspension rate issue is really part of a much larger debate that goes back some decades on the left, and that's about whether, you know, wherever we see racial disparity, it's automatically evidence of racism, of something amiss. And that is sort of a worldview held by many on the left, and certainly held by many in the Obama administration. And so whether we're talking about you know, bank loans or incarceration rates or passage of the bar exam, wherever they find racially disparate outcomes, the assumption is that something nefarious is going on. And the courts have, over the decades, blessed this reasoning in some cases. And but what I found particularly troubling about applying it to what's going on in terms of discipline rates in school is that I think, you know, education is one area, particularly K through 12 education, is an area where there's really the most hope of closing these disparities if these kids can get a decent education. And I look at this from the standpoint of the students who are in school to learn, and that's where my sympathies lie. And I don't understand how you help those students who are in school to learn by going easy on the kids who are in school to act out, make trouble, and be disruptive. And so I think the left is coddling the wrong group of kids here. And that's what I found so troubling about applying this standard that the Obama administration did with that Dear Colleague letter. And it really started earlier than sending out the letter. They had issued this study back in, I believe, 2012 out of the Education Department, and noting the disparities that you talked about, and signaling to school districts that, you know, if we don't see racial parity in school discipline, we're coming after you. And I just think, as you said, it sends exactly the wrong message that schools are going to start disciplining children based on the color of their skin rather than disciplining children based on who is, in fact, misbehaving. And that makes for a much more disruptive learning environment and, again, leaves those kids worse off who are there to get an education.
You talked in your column also about an interesting exchange between Denzel Washington, the famous African American movie actor, and some reporters. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, it was at a screening of his latest film, where he plays a defense attorney, and one of the journalists at the screening approached him and asked him about sort of can we make advances, make changes as black people. The reporter herself was black, was asking this question in an environment like this one. And I thought there were sort of political overtones to it. You know, she didn't mention the Trump administration or the president by name, but she was clearly implying that these are difficult times for blacks, and you know, what can we do? And he didn't really take the bait. He gave a very sort of traditionalist answer. He said it all starts at home. You know, you boys need a father in the home, and he elaborated on that when he was pressed on it. And he said, you know, I can't really blame the system. We've got to make sure that these young men in particular have the right role models in place. And we can't blame the system for what happens if they don't. And yes, you're right. It was a rather surprising answer to come from a celebrity, although I should say in Denzel Washington's defense that he's been saying these sorts of things for some time. He's a longtime spokesman for the Boys and Girls Club of America, and so he has commented on these issues before, but he does what he says gets at a larger point. And again, to bring it back to what's going on in the schools in terms of discipline, is why should we expect to find behavior inside of schools that we don't find outside of schools? In other words, there's not racial parity and disciplinary outcomes outside of the schoolroom. Why would we expect to find them in the schoolroom? I mean, do we think all this bad behavior starts only after the kids graduate? You know, obviously it does not. And so even the premise of what the Obama administration was pushing for, I thought was off base. We should never have expected to find racial parity and suspension rates in school, just like we don't find racial parity and who commits crimes and who's incarcerated outside of school.
Yeah, and it's a little bit ironic, you know, when you think about it, because, you know, the left for a long time has said that, you know, crime and poverty, you know, are related. And since there are disparities, you know, in poverty, you know, you would expect there to be disparities in crime, and you would expect there to be disparities in other kinds of you know, social pathologies. So, you know, by the left's own lights, you know, it would be you know, counterintuitive to find, you know, these problems evenly distributed around along racial lines. Now, there might be, you know, differences between conservatives and liberals in explaining, you know, why these disparities in poverty occur. But, you know, the left should be as unsurprised as the right that the disparities and things that, that grow out of poverty, you know.
Yeah. And we also find, Roger, differences in group behavior, whether we're breaking it down by race or ethnicity or by gender or in other ways. You know, the as you know in writing and in research regarding affirmative action policies, over the years, when you invoke, for instance, Asians in these discussions, instead of just talking about it in terms of black and white, it often upsets the argument that the left is often trying to make here. So if you take school discipline, yes, blacks are suspended at higher rates than whites, but whites are suspended at higher rates than Asians. Are the policies anti-white? And you could extend that to other areas, whether we're talking about something like bank loans. You know, blacks are denied loans at higher rates than whites, and whites are denied loans at higher rates than Asians. Again, are the banks discriminating against whites? And by the way, this holds true for black-owned banks who also deny blacks loans at higher rates than they deny loans to whites and Asians, which also gets you back into the school system. And this argument does not acknowledge the personnel in many of these schools where blacks are being suspended at such high rates. Many of the teachers, many of the principals, many of the administrators are themselves black who are doing this. Do they hold some racial animus toward other blacks? Or is something else going on here that has nothing to do with racism? And so this idea, again, that we can jump to the conclusion that racial animus is involved everywhere we see racial disparities, I think the evidence just does not back that up. That is just an overly reductive way of looking at things.
All very well said, Jason. And, you know, I'm going to, you know, now broaden the discussion a little bit, to make an additional point. You know, my own view is that all of these disparities, you know, the single biggest reason that we see these disparities, you know, the sort of root cause of all of them, you know, whether we're talking about poverty or crime or school discipline or substance abuse or unemployment or, you name, you know, the social problem, you know, educational outcomes, traces back to the huge disparity that we see in this country in out-of-wedlock birth rates. And all of these problems, I think, are shown to be worse for people who grow up in homes without a father. I think this is, you know, one of the points that Denzel Washington, you know, was alluding to. And when I say that there are huge disparities, you know, in these rates, let me be, you know, concrete in what I'm talking about. 7 out of 10 African Americans now are born out of wedlock. 7 out of 10. More than 6 out of 10 Native Americans, you know, American Indians and, you know, Alaska Natives and Native Hawaiians are born out of wedlock. More than 5 out of 10 Latinos are born out of wedlock, versus fewer than 3 out of 10 non-Hispanic whites, and fewer than 2 out of 10 Asian Americans, which, you know, you were talking about before. Now, that is a huge range, you know, all the way from fewer than 2 out of 10 to 7 out of 10. And when you look at how well, you know, different groups are doing, you know, again, whether you're looking at educational outcomes, school discipline, crime, employment, you know, whatever you look at, those disparities line up very well with how well the different groups are doing. You know, the groups that have lower out-of-wedlock birth rates are doing, you know, much better than the groups with higher out-of-wedlock birth rates. And I think that this is you know, a critically important fact. The point that you make, that this is not about race and not about racism, is shown by the fact that these disparities exist within groups as well. That is, if you look just at whites, you know, as Charles Murray, for example, did in his book, you know, Coming Apart, you know, he looked at just whites. You know, he took race out of the equation. And, you know, and, you know, other researchers have done this too. Among whites, kids who grow up out of wedlock, you know, in homes without a father, you see the same dramatic disparities
right.
in social disparities,
right.
You know, in these different social problems. The same problems with crime, with drug abuse, with unemployment, with not doing well in school. All of that is true for whites as well. You know, this is fundamentally.
Well, you're right, but even more to the point, Roger, among blacks who marry before having children, the poverty rate is in the single digits and has been for more than 20 years. In other words, blacks aren't immune to the good things that happen when you do things in an order that produces positive socioeconomic results. In other words, those benefits accrue to blacks who do things in that order as well. Again, showing that the idea that we can blame these negative outcomes on racism per se doesn't hold water. It doesn't hold up against the evidence that we have. I'd make two additional points, though. One is that it has not always been this way. It has not always been this bad. Not to say that there weren't disparities in the past, but they were not as wide, nowhere near as wide as what they are today, these black-white disparities on things like marriage and out-of-wedlock birth rates. You go back to the late 1800s, all the way through the 1930s and 40s, you saw black marriage rates exceeding white marriage rates nationwide. You go back to as recently as the mid-1960s, you had 2 out of 3 black children being raised by a mother and a father, versus today, which you said 7 in 10 are not. So this is not, we don't need to reinvent the wheel here when it comes to what's happened to the black nuclear family. It's not always been this way, and we know that based on that history that we have. But again, it shows that this argument that all of these things can be laid to white racism is simply not the case. And I keep returning to that because on the left, that is the all-purpose explanation for these racial disparities.
Again, thank you, Jason. You know, very well said. I want to pivot now and talk about your book, False Black Power, which, keeping with the season, I think would be a terrific stocking stuffer for our listeners. But gets to this point you're making about how the left's nostrums in this area have been consistently wrong. But before I do that, Laura, would you like to make the announcement so that one of the things that Jason and I were discussing that we wanted to do was to allow plenty of time for people to phone in with questions that they had. So could you give the instructions for people to do that, and then Jason and I will talk a little bit about his book and then start taking some questions.
Yes, in a moment you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We will answer questions in the order in which they are received. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad.
Well, as I said, Jason, you've written a wonderful book, which is available now, called False Black Power. And could you talk a little bit about how you came to write that book and what it says and what's in it?
Well, the book is really a critique of a civil rights strategy that has been in place, particularly since the 1960s. That is, since the passage of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 and the Civil Rights Act of 1964, and what happened in the wake of the passage of those acts is that black leaders decided to put an especially heavy emphasis on electing black officials, putting more blacks in office. And the thinking was that if they were able to do that, the socioeconomic gains would flow naturally from that political clout. And so that's what they proceeded to do. And I felt that the Obama presidency was really the culmination of this strategy, a black president, and that it would be a good time to look back and see whether the strategy had in fact produced the intended results, had the accumulation of black political clout culminating in the presidency, twice elected black president, produced the economic gains that we were told would follow. And that's really what prompted the book. And as you may not be surprised to find out, what was promised has not come to pass. Huge disparities remain in place, and I set about explaining why that is the case in the book.
Yeah, and it's as I say, it's terrific. It's not a terribly long book. It's got a lot of, you know, you get a lot of bang for the buck with it. It has a lot of it really punches above its weight, and I should say that it's also got a couple of, you know, additional essays by, a couple of, I'm going to call them, maverick African-American, intellectuals who, not necessarily always conservatives, but, both of them, I think, do not take issue with your basic point. Can you talk a little bit about those
right
responses that are in the book?
I wanted to find two black independent thinkers, and I found that in two academics, John McWhorter, who is based at Columbia now, formerly of Berkeley, and Glenn Lowry, who's an economist at Brown University currently. And both of them have spent a lot of time over the years thinking about these issues and more importantly, thinking for themselves. And not being afraid to challenge the sort of black civil rights orthodoxy when it comes to explaining racial issues in this country, and they did not disappoint. If you get a chance to read the book, you'll obviously see that two very thoughtful people who sort of quibble with what I have to say more so than disagreeing. Particularly McWhorter, who I think. I think he thinks I give too much credit to the sort of power that or influence that the current civil rights leadership groups like the NAACP or folks like Jesse Jackson still have, and he says you're giving them too much credit. I push back a little bit against that because, being a journalist, I think that their power in part derives from the fact that people in the media keep turning to them to speak on behalf of Black America every time we get a Ferguson, Missouri, or something along those lines. And so I think in part their power derives from that the media continues to turn to them. But the two very, very thoughtful responses, so I was very happy they agreed to do it.
I should say that I'm looking at it right now. John McWhorter begins his, his piece by saying Jason Riley's critique is fundamentally correct. That's the, the opening line there. And I think that, Glenn Lowry takes, again, while both of them are quite independent, they bring their own perspective to it. I think that there's, basic agreement on the, the fundamental correctness of your.
Yeah,
of your analysis.
And the book also, what I'm trying to do is explain that this strategy that the black civil rights leaders had has been successful in one sense, which is that we have elected a good number of black officials, since this strategy was put in place. I think the number of black elected officials in this country has grown from fewer than 1,500 in 1970 to more than 10,000 today, including, of course, a black president. And it was evident in black mayors were elected throughout the by the 1990s, we'd elected over 300 black mayors, including in major cities, Cleveland, Philadelphia, Baltimore, New York, Los Angeles. And in addition to black state legislators and a whole congressional black caucus, and we had racially gerrymandered voting districts to ensure that they had safe seats. We've had black governors. We've had black police chiefs and school superintendents and so forth. So blacks are not lacking for political clout in this country. That strategy has succeeded on those terms. What hasn't happened, however, is what we were told would happen, which is that the black economic progress has not been there. So if you look at Coleman Young's Detroit or Sharp James's Newark or Marion Barry's Washington, D.C., the black poor became poorer on their watch, which is not to say that the black poor got poorer because there was a black mayor. That's not the point. I'm not making a causal link. What I'm saying is that black political clout alone was clearly not enough, and it hasn't been enough. And even a black president did not make it enough. If you look at measures such as home ownership, household income, poverty, the black-white divide all widened under Obama on all of those fronts. So clearly something more than political capital is needed if we're going to close these racial gaps. And in the book, I explain that what's missing is that human capital development, what economists refer to as human capital. That is what went by the wayside when this strategy shifted to focusing on electing more black officials. Earlier, we were talking about those marriage rates and those black illegitimacy rates in the first half of the 20th century. Well, what was going on in black America when we had those high marriage rates, when we had those lower black illegitimacy rates, is we saw racial gaps closing in poverty, closing in income, closing in educational attainment, closing in terms of entering the skilled professions. All those gaps were closing, slowly but steadily closing. Post-60s environment, after I would argue the welfare interventions, the Great Society and the like, those trends either slowed, stalled, or in some cases reversed course. And I think what is needed is not a focus on achieving political clout, but a focus on developing human capital, what blacks were focused on in the first half of the 20th century.
Very good. Before we turn it over to the audience for questions, I want to make one specific legal point on this that I think is important. You know, we began by talking about the use of the disparate impact approach that the Obama administration used aggressively, you know, in the context of school discipline. And that's the context in which I want to make this legal point. The basis for using the disparate impact approach comes from its interpretation of some regulations, Department of Education regulations that it has that were promulgated under Title VI of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which bans discrimination in federally funded programs. And since just about every school district in the country, you know, gets federal money, therefore they have to comply with Title VI. Of course, school districts are also required to comply with the Constitution. The problem is that Title VI has been interpreted, by the Supreme Court as being coextensive with the Constitution, which means that it bans only disparate treatment, that is, actual racial discrimination on the basis of race, not things that simply have a disparate impact, you know, that lead to statistical disproportions. So the legality of using regulations to challenge policies that do not violate Title VI, that do not violate the statute itself, is, I think, very problematic. And the Supreme Court has recognized this problem. You know, in a case called Alexander versus Sandoval in the year 2000, Justice Scalia wrote an opinion for the court in which he dropped a footnote that said that, you know, there is this, you know, surprising that you have regulations that purport to make things illegal, which the statute itself says are not illegal. So in addition to there being these policy problems with the disparate impact approach that the Education Department, you know, took in the Obama administration in this area, there's also this legal problem as well. So anyway, since this is the Federalist Society, I wanted to make this, you know, that narrow legal, narrow but important, I think, legal point.
And I believe in the guidance letter, Roger, it says something to the effect of, even if your disciplinary policy is race neutral, we don't care.
That's absolutely right.
Yeah, if the outcomes are disproportionate, look out, right?
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And, of course, that is, you know, that is the definition of the disparate impact approach. That is that policies that are neutral on their face, that are neutrally applied, and that were neutrally intended can nonetheless be struck down as illegally discriminatory if they have racially disproportionate results. I think that that's outrageous as a matter of policy, and it's also, you know, in many, unfortunately, there are some instances where Congress has enacted statutes that take the disparate impact approach. Now, I think that the constitutionality of those statutes is open to question. That's a, you know, an issue for another day. But where the statutes themselves do not take a disparate impact approach and instead ban only actual racial discrimination, actual disparate treatment, for regulations to ban things that have only a disparate impact is, I think, legally very problematic, in addition to being bad policy for all the reasons that we've
Right,
done.
I really can't overstate the effects, the real world effects of what the left is trying to do here in the name of helping blacks. There's been the anecdotal evidence coming, reports in places like Buffalo, New York school system and Minneapolis school system. But we've also had some empirical studies done. One was done by my colleague, Max Eden, at the Manhattan Institute about New York City disciplinary policies, a sort of before and after take after they changed their suspension policy. A more recent one was just done by the Fordham Institute of the Philadelphia school system, which changed their suspension policy, again, under threat of action by the federal government. And when what you saw was an increase in disruptiveness in schools and a decrease in performance in schools when you did these before and after comparisons. It also helps to speak to some of these low-income black parents and to understand the importance that they place on safety in a school. And it's something many of us, fortunately, can simply take for granted. We will send our kid off to school, and we're not worried about them getting beat up. We're not worried about them getting bullied. They don't walk through metal detectors to get in and out of school. We just take that sort of thing for granted. In many of these inner cities, you don't take that for granted. And the premium that you place simply on making sure your kid gets home safe every day cannot be overstated. You take one of these low-income inner-city parents and tell them that school A has the same test scores as school B, high or low test scores, but I can make sure at school B, or school B has a much better track record when it comes to safety, they're going to pick school B every time, which is one of the reasons, again, that school choice has long pulled off the charts among low-income blacks. if an inner city parent has a choice between their neighborhood school and a charter school, and even if the academic record of both schools is exactly the same, they are going to take the charter school every time because they have peace of mind in terms of safety of their child. And what these policies are doing are making schools less safe. And increasingly, we can show that empirically, not just anecdotally. And again, that is a very, very important point to stress, I think, in this debate.
Another of your books was titled, Please Stop Helping Us, which I think is sort of sums up the plea that we're making to the, on behalf of the people who are supposedly being helped by these policies to the
I think this this really gets into the debate, a lot of the debates over criminal justice reform and the over-incarceration or mass incarceration debate that you have. The left always seems to approach these issues from the standpoint of the offender rather than of the victims or the potential victims. And I was listening to Hillary Clinton on the campaign trail talk about how too many people are in prison and we need to let more of them out. These are low-level offenders, and I can be assured that they won't become violent or so forth. And I would sit back and go, she can say that because when they get out, they are not headed to her neighborhood.
Yep.
Hillary Clinton lives in one of the toniest neighborhoods in all of New York, in all of the country. Violent crime is basically non-existent. So are black people where she lives. And so she can sit up there and say, oh, yes, we need to let these poor guys out without having any concern at all that they're heading back to her community where she's got children or grandchildren or what have you. But who goes into these neighborhoods where these guys head back and say, are you going to be worse off or better off if we let these if we send these guys back to the hood sooner rather than later? That seems to be a secondary concern at best for many of the people pushing for these policies. And I think it's of a piece of what we see happening with this school discipline debate. Who's better off and who's worse off? And where should our sympathies lie?
Very good. Well, I don't think either one of us has said anything, controversial or thought-provoking today, Jason. So I'll be astonished if there are any callers. But let's go ahead and see if there are anyway. Laura?
We have two people lined up, so let's go to our first audience question.
Hi, Marianne McGrail. I'm an attorney in D.C. An observation and a question. I sat on the board of a charter school in Massachusetts, which initially admitted by lottery a third of its students who were disciplinary, had been categorized as special needs students, but were in fact disciplinary problems. What that school did was require the parents, and of course the parents had self-selected to put their kids in the lottery for a charter school, require the parents to agree that if their children committed any of a number of offenses, they could be suspended or expelled. That policy worked extremely well. So my question here is going to the root of the problem. If you get more parental buy-in up front, parents agree these are the rules for the kids, they violate them, they're going to be, can the rate of suspension and expulsion for minority students be decreased?
Thank you very much. Go ahead, Jason.
Well, I think buy-in is obviously very important, and it's something that that a lot of charter schools utilize. The ones I've been familiar with often require parents and students to sign. Roger, maybe you could start while I catch my breath here.
Sure. No, I think that's right. And this, you know, it gets to the point, you know, Jason, that you were making earlier, that, you know, in the communities themselves, you know, where this is happening, there is nothing but solidarity with students or with teachers, you know, who want to maintain order in classrooms. And I thought, you know, while you were talking before, that, you know, if you give a parent a choice between a school where, you know, their child is going to be safe versus sending their child to a school where they're not going to be safe, you know, what parent, you know, I'm a parent, you know, what parent is not going to have safety as the, you know, the primary priority, you know, for where their child goes to school? And I think that, you know, getting, you know, buy-in from parents is important. I think this is another reason why, you know, charter schools and people being able to send their children to schools where, you know, they have some say and some sense of efficacy in participating in the school and in making sure that it's responsive, you know, to the child's, you know, most fundamental needs is very important. And, you know, I think the caller is quite right to, you know, to make that point.
Yeah, and sorry about that. I had a coughing fit there. But the other thing I'd add is I've heard a number of reports about schools doing what the caller suggested this school had done, public schools steering disciplinary cases to nearby charter schools. And it's funny because it's the charter schools that get accused of creaming all the time, right, Roger?
Right, yeah, that's right.
But in this, in several cases, the one example comes to mind, it was either Washington, D.C. or Los Angeles. Well, Los Angeles seems to stick out, if I remember correctly. But in the Los Angeles public school system, disciplinary cases were being steered by guidance counselors and principals to nearby charter schools. And I found that very interesting, but yes, buy-in as the charter networks have discovered, buy-in from parents is key. The question, however, is what kind of demands traditional public schools can make on parents, and of course they're very limited in the demands that they can make, and that's the problem. And if they can't make those demands, what can they do to remove disruptive kids from the classroom or from the school when they need to? And that's the problem here with this federal guidance, that I think schools should be given more freedom to remove disciplinary cases for the sake of the learning environment, for the sake of the kids who are there to learn. And and the feds in this case have other priorities, and that's a problem.
Related to, you know, the popularity of charter schools, I should note that I think that, you know, part of the attraction of parochial schools, you know, has also been the fact that, you know, they take discipline very seriously there. You know, as anybody who's been to a parochial school, you know, can tell you. And I think that, you know, again, for a long time, you know, if you were unhappy with the way, you know, with your local, you know, public school in an inner city area, you know, the parochial schools were the one, this is particularly, you know, prior to the advent of charter schools, that parochial schools were the, you know, a good alternative.
And the other thing we should add is in a lot of these troubled inner city schools, you have the worst performing teachers, frankly. They get steered into those schools because many of these jobs are seniority-based. And so while kids don't have a lot of school choice, teachers do, particularly as they work longer and longer in the profession. They can pick their schools. And many of them opt out of these tougher inner-city schools, leaving the newbies, leaving the less experienced teachers, or the worst-performing teachers, teachers that have been vetted by better schools and more active parents and shuffled into the less demanding schools with the more inattentive parents.
And that also is going to reflect school discipline, the teacher's ability to run the classroom. And so this sort of feeds on itself, and it speaks to who goes into teaching and how we reward teachers who are eager to go into teaching or discourage them from doing so based on the credentialing that takes place or some of the degrees they have to get and so forth. And so I think that is also a factor in the school discipline debate that doesn't get a lot of attention.
Good point. Laura, do we have other questions?
Yes, let's go to our next audience question.
Talking about the economic impacts of various things on various groups, I'm often criticizing our current tax suggestions and the bill that we see because it ignores the Laffer curve, the fact that when you have tax rates over 28%, the government actually loses money because people have an incentive to stop reporting the income. But if you look at the tax rates on people who are on disability or on welfare, they could effectively, when they get their first job, lose all their subsidy, the tax rates of thousands of percent. And once you're in that situation, you'd have to be crazy to start working. So I think that's a huge factor in what the welfare system has done to reduce the overall prosperity of different minorities. I can give you the experience of a friend who was a teacher in Roosevelt High School here on Long Island, who was good enough to get Shakespearean performances out of kids in the South Bronx. And she said when she got to Roosevelt, she was not allowed to teach. They just didn't let her. They put people in the kids in the class who just wouldn't allow the class to go forward. And there was nothing that they would do to remove them.
Well, I certainly agree with everything the caller just said, particularly his first point about the disincentives that can be put in place through the welfare state. If you're going to pay people to not work, they're not going to work. And if you're going to, if it pays, particularly for a single mom to stay out of the labor force because the benefits she's accruing while not working are greater than what she can make in an entry-level position, she's not going to go for that entry-level position. I think she'll, and she's behaving rationally when she makes that decision. I think we have to be very careful about that. We tried to address some of that with the Clinton welfare reforms in 1996. But we didn't address it entirely. I think it's better than what it was. But some of that's been loosened, particularly after the Great Recession. The Fed suspended some of those workfare requirements that states had put in place. So there's been some slippage on that front. But I think we could do a lot more, a lot better.
You know, I was thinking, Jason, the other day about, the contribution that, the neoconservatives, made to the conservative movement, in the in its heyday in the late 60s and early 1970s. And I think that, their insight can really be boiled down to, two words, unintended consequences.
Yeah.
And, that I think is, their insight that a lot of, well-intended, liberal policies have had, these unintended consequences of, in many cases, encouraging kinds of behaviors that turn out to be very bad, and of course, the welfare system is a classic example of that. And without too much trouble, you can apply the same principle to things like incarceration policies and school discipline and so forth. So yeah, that's. Point well taken. Laura, anybody else there?
We have one more question lined up. Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad.
Thank you both for pointing out that discrimination that disparities can be caused by many factors. Discrimination is only one of them. One of the problems with the Dear Colleague approach to creating educational policy is that it doesn't go through the normal regulatory process where there can be some checks and balances. My question is, when DOE promulgated this policy, was it based on any research that could be qualified as independent or objective or scholarly, or was this essentially just an ideological proclamation?
Did they start with the answer to their question? This effort predates the Obama administration. This is something that has been going on. Mid 2000s, I think, is probably when it gained some footing. Now, I think that the administration certainly helped things along and has exacerbated the problem, but it's part of this idea of what's called the school-to-prison pipeline. And the thinking there is that kids who get suspended from school are more likely to enter the criminal justice system later in life. And I think the argument, the pushback there is that that's a confusion of correlation and causation. It may very well be true that someone who has been suspended from school multiple times is more likely to drop out, and they're more likely to end up involved in the criminal justice system. But it doesn't mean that that the suspensions are what caused that outcome. But that's I think the thinking behind this study. But it wasn't the first study to reach these conclusions. That is the government study. But I think the people who put it together knew what they were looking for in terms of the outcome, and they arrived where they expected to arrive in terms of their conclusions.
Yeah, I think that's right, and I think the caller, and I believe I recognize the dulcet tones of the voice of George Lanou in the caller, makes the good point that there were procedural problems. There are procedural problems with using Dear Colleague letters to essentially change or expand or alter the way that regulations work. That's not the way that the Administrative Procedure Act is supposed to work, and there's been a lot written on that abuse in particular. So I think that's another point well taken. There's also
Go ahead.
I was going to say that there's some controversy about whether the regulations themselves in this area are best interpreted. Certainly, I think they certainly should not be interpreted the way that that they're being interpreted in this Dear Colleague letter. And I think that I recently read a discussion that one could interpret these regulations as actually not allowing for the disparate impact approach at all. So, the point that there are sort of administrative procedure problems with this Dear Colleague letter are important. And in terms of the underlying sociology here, unfortunately, you can find, I think, as Jason says, there's been, work done that purports to find, these racial disparities. But again, on the other hand, I think if you look at it objectively, those studies are problematic. And there was another study that was done that, I cited, and I think it's the American Journal Sociological Review or something like that, that says that the misbehavior, the discipline disparity rates can all be explained by the fact that there are, differences, predictable differences in the discipline problems. That is, you know, the students who tend to get, you know, suspended are ones who, you know, have, you know, who are discipline problems. So, you know, there's good studies and bad studies, and I take the caller's point that if there had been, you know, serious look at the underlying evidence here, that you know, this approach would not have been taken either. I'm sorry, Jason, but you know, you had a point you wanted to make.
No, I just wanted to stress that that my argument is not that that America or the education system is free of racism. That there aren't racist teachers or principals or what have you, administrators. That's not what I'm arguing. Nor am I arguing that there isn't plenty of racism outside of the classroom in U.S. society. The question for me is whether you can plausibly blame racism for the outcomes we see, and how do you tease out what is due to racism and what is due to other factors. And I think the evidence that these disparities can be blamed mostly, let alone entirely, on racism, I just find that very lacking in the data that we have. And so I just wanted to make that final point.
Very good. I will find the site that that I alluded to there, and we will post that on the Federalist Society, you know, website, where you'll also be able to find the you know, the link to the podcast that will be made from this discussion. Well, Jason, thank you very much. I said at the outset that I was looking forward to this, and it's been all that I hoped it would be. Thank you very much for participating, and for your insights and for your good work. Please, you know, keep up the good work. And again, thank you to the Federalist Society for making this possible. And Laura, I'm going to turn it back over to you for any to close this out.
Thank you.
Our next Teleforum conference call is scheduled for tomorrow, December 22nd at 2 p.m. Eastern. That call will be on a change of guard at the CFPB and will feature Professor John Eastman of Chapman University. A reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming Teleforum calls, and to consult the full schedule of our upcoming calls on the Federalist Society's website, fedsoc.org. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.